In this week's debriefing of the law, the Supreme Court has joined the 21st century, and now their proceedings will be live streamed during May. Step aside, Judge Judy, you now have competition. A Miami doctor who was fighting the coronavirus on the front lines has temporarily lost custody of her children. And as a reward for your selfless act of courage, doctor, we now will take your kids. Hey, at least she doesn't have to homeschool them. And Mackenzie Smith is back with us this week to unpack the movie Philadelphia, which is rather convenient for her since Mackenzie is from Philadelphia. Well, welcome to this week's debriefing of the law. Today's podcast is brought to you by Digital Directory Management. Did you know that 73% of consumers lost trust in a local business when they found incorrect information about that business online? I know I do. When I found out that that prince in Nigeria didn't actually need access to my bank account, I was irate. Well, seriously, if we depend upon the internet and we Google something and it says, hey, this place opens at 8 o'clock, and it's 8:01 and the doors are not open, you basically have lost all trust in that business. That is why Digital Directory Management exists. You can contact them to make sure that your online presence matches reality. Contact them at www.digitaldirectory.management. That is www.digitaldirectory.management. Welcome to this week's debriefing of the law. Today's guest again, I probably shouldn't even call her a guest because she's now been on three times, is Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, it's great to have you on.
Great to be back.
Now, last week we talked about the best legal movie of all time, My Cousin Vinny. This week we're going to discuss Philadelphia. And since we've already had a little bit of conversation, I know you have a lot of great thoughts about Philadelphia. But just real quickly, did you watch this movie with your family?
I actually watched this one alone.
Okay.
Yeah, they just weren't, you know, in the right mindset. And I have to say, like, you know, being quarantined for so long and kind of being isolated, it is a very emotional experience when you sit down and watch this movie in a room by yourself.
I kind of forgotten about that. It was made in 1993, I think, is when it came out, but we're gonna get there in just a bit. But first I want to just unpack some of the significant legal issues of this past week. We've had an interesting week, even though we are all in quarantine or lockdown mode, which actually leads us to our first case. This ER doctor. Now, last week, you and I, Mackenzie, we talked about the different legal ramifications with the coronavirus. And I got to tell you, we pegged it. Listeners, if you don't believe me, go back and re-listen to last week. We predicted that one of the legal problems with the coronavirus will come with visitation and custody rights. Did we not peg that, Mackenzie?
We totally did. I mean, we're basically the best lawyers ever.
Stay tuned for our picks here for Vegas. I was going to say your football picks, but since we don't have sports anymore, let's just skip those. You might have read about this case, but an ER doctor in Florida, she had custody of her 4-year-old daughter, and a court this week took that custody away from her. She lost temporary custody of her child because she's an emergency room doctor and subjected to the coronavirus, I guess, in her job. What do you take of that case?
You know, this is what I did read about this, and it's so tragic, you know, to have that happen when you, as a professional, you're doing not only your job, but obviously putting yourself at risk and really stepping up in a time of unprecedented crisis, obviously.
I mean, these guys are our heroes, right? They are actually facing this disease that actually causes death at a fairly high rate, much higher than any of us are comfortable with. She's facing that every day. And hey, as a reward, Dr. Green, let's take your daughter away.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the most tragic thing about this case is the judge did the right thing, arguably. I mean, the standard for child custody cases is always the best interest of the child. And whether it's painful to the parents is, I mean, I I'm not a custody attorney, but I don't even think it's like a secondary concern. I think it's really like not a concern. It's only best interest of the child. So using that as the legal standard, you can't really say that the judge did the wrong thing. But it's it's tragic, you know, and this is one of those cases where it's just such a shame that the parents could not work it out. I mean, it's like, what a shame.
Right. Exactly. This is, guys, figure a way to work this out. Don't put the 4-year-old in the middle. But man, that is a tough, tough issue. And so she told CNN, "I think it's not fair. It's cruel to ask me to choose between my child and the oath I took as a physician. I won't abandon my team at work or the patients who will increasingly look to me to save their lives in the coming weeks. But it's torture." So, yeah, we need these type of people on the front lines of fighting the coronavirus, taking care of patients, but to realize that now they are going to lose custody of their kids, as you said very well, it's just tragic. Have you heard of any other cases out there like that?
I mean, I'm sure there are, not that I've personally read about or looked at, but I'm sure that this is not an isolated incident. And you just kind of hope that this 4-year-old child and whatever other kids are, you know, having this happen to them, that they will grow up and look back and realize that their parents were doing the right thing and they were heroes, and they will have an example of the right kind of, you know, human being to be for that doctor to say, "I'm not abandoning my team. I'm not abandoning my patients." I mean, she's obviously doing the right thing morally.
Right.
Daughter will grow up and you know, recognize that, and you just kind of play the long game that way and put your nose to the grindstone and try and get through it. And I would have to believe and imagine that the judge, you know, this is a temporary situation and they'll be able to go back to court, and the judge will, you know, even everything out in the long run. So that's what you just kind of have to hope for.
Now, this is in Miami, which I would imagine is a far cry different scenario than where I'm from, Kansas City. I have talked to some ER doctors locally here, and they're saying, yeah, they're not getting any cases. These hospitals are now pretty much bare because you can't have elective procedures. You can't have normal hospital things being done. And so, yeah, they're not getting coronavirus patients as well. And so they're kind of playing solitaire at the ER because they're just not getting a lot of work. But again, this case here is from Miami, so I'm sure it's a far different scenario. Well, Mackenzie, because it has been a slow go on the legal front, it's kind of hard to find some headlines. I did find this headline where Lori Loughlin is being quarantined with her husband and not with her daughters. Now, apparently this is legal news because if you're aware, she is involved in this pay-for-play scheme where they allegedly bribed schools to let their kids into these schools. Have you heard of that lawsuit?
Oh yeah, no, I'm definitely not that oblivious. I haven't heard about it, and it's like, I love how you corrected yourself. They bribed. I mean, allegedly bribed, but I think
that's right. Allegedly.
I think also this week the photos came out or were made public of like the daughters posing on rowing machines, and it's just like, yeah, like they allegedly bribed, but you know, we can kind of feel pretty safe in saying that there's something shady going on, and Aunt Becky is not the woman we thought she was.
Hey, now that's trash talk right there. Don't be ragging on Aunt Becky. She's still my hero. She just didn't know how to bribe the right way, right? You give money to the university, you put your name on a building with a wink and a nod, and then your kids are admitted the next year. That's how you do it. But apparently they did not follow all the right steps.
That's right. And they could have. That's the weird thing about it. Like, just do bribery the legal way. Like, what's wrong with you people? You have a ton of money.
Hire your lawyers. Don't see when you skip your lawyers, you're going to have to pay the price. If she would have went through her lawyers, they would have just given the money to the university, which, by the way, that's another thought. This is a state university in California. I'm just going to suggest, if your daughters cannot get into the state university, maybe that's not where they want to be. Maybe that's not their calling in life. I don't know. But again, that's just my take. I might be way off here from Kansas. But you found a case this last week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court election case. What did you find out about that case?
So, yeah, this is all over the news with the Wisconsin primary election, which was last week. And, you know, I kept reading so many different things about what was going on. And we all know that I think it was last Tuesday, April 7th, everyone had to go vote in person because the court somehow like required everyone to go vote and they stopped mail-in ballots or whatever. So I couldn't make heads or tails of what actually happened in the legal proceedings. So I went straight to the source and like the nerd that I am, printed out the Supreme Court decision, the United States Supreme Court decision. There's also a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. And okay, I read it.
Now, before you get there, I want to just get your opinion on the facts of this case, the setup. Because when I have voted in primary elections before, they have been practicing social distancing well before the coronavirus. I mean, I was pretty much the only one there, maybe a couple other people. No one else is there. So what was this lawsuit about?
So, okay, I completely agree. I also vote in primary elections and there's like never anyone there. But I think that there were some state positions that were really contested that were also at issue. I think there were maybe one or two seats on the state Supreme Court. So there was more, you know, interest in this primary than just like your general presidential primary where we already know who the nominee is going to be and no one actually goes to vote. And I also, from reading about this, have learned that Wisconsin is like a very split state currently. Like it's very one side or the other. There's like half the population is Democrat, half is Republican, and it's very contentious. There are some agricultural issues that have been very contentious and have divided the population of the state. So there's that aspect of it too. But
so when it comes to cheese curds, they're in agreement, but outside of cheese curds, it's a split state. Okay, I gotcha.
That's exactly right. So I guess the primary election was supposed to be on April 7th. And typically, you know, you would go vote in person that day. And if you had a mail-in ballot, it would have to be received by election day. So the governor did not postpone the primary. I guess originally he was saying he did not have the power to do so. But then at the last minute, he tried to do it. And the Republican state legislature tried to block him, and that went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I guess the compromise or what ended up happening is they decided, you know, we're going to have the election that day. Oh, yeah. So they decided that they were going to have the election that day, or the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided that. And then the Democratic Committee of Wisconsin and the Democratic National Committee sued in federal district court for an injunction requiring the state elections board to accept mail-in ballots later than April 7th, so long as they were postmarked by April 7th. And the federal district court judge not only granted that, but then also said they can be postmarked after April 7th, so long as they're received by April 13th. And that was relief that the Democratic committees didn't even ask for. And apparently it was relief that was illegal under Wisconsin state law, but the federal district judge just like sua sponte decided that it was a pandemic and it was a crisis and, you know, this was going to be allowed. So it got appealed
to
the Supreme Court. Yeah.
Let's see if I understand this. So what the plaintiffs were asking for, the prayer for relief, was that we want you to accept mail-in ballots that you might have received a week late or by a date certain, but they had to be postmarked by the election date.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
But the district court, and is this a federal district court, I'm assuming, or state?
Federal district court.
Federal district court ruled that we're going to go one better than that, and we are going to say whether or not they were postmarked by a date certain, you have to count them as long as you receive them by this extended period of time. Okay, so how did the court rule?
So the court overturned the federal district judge, And there was a lot of press about this decision, and there were a lot of outcries that now people who had not received their mail-in ballot, because I guess part of the problem is people had applied for a mail-in ballot like at the last minute because they didn't know how long the quarantine was going to last and the stay-at-home orders. So they were planning on going to vote in person up until, you know, a week or two before the election, and then applied for a mail-in ballot at the last minute, hadn't received it by the eve of election day. So their concern was, well, what if I don't receive it until April 8th or April 9th? Then I'll have to go vote in person. So there was a lot of outcry. But basically what the Supreme Court said is, you know, as a district court, you cannot grant relief that was not requested as part of the filing. And that's illegal under state law. And there was basically like a wink and a nod in the decision. Like, it is not wise to not have postponed the primary. Like, you guys should have just postponed it, but that's not before us. You know, we're constrained to rule, you know, in favor of, I guess, the Republicans, the Republican state legislature in this situation. And it was portrayed as such a divisive decision and forcing people to go vote in person who had not received their mail-in ballots, which was the practical result. But at the same time, it's one of those situations where it's a slippery slope. Like, you don't want to start making exceptions and allowing for such judicial activism in the name of a pandemic and a crisis, because where does that end, really? I mean, you can end up in complete lawlessness with district judges just like running the country how they see fit, and that's definitely not okay. So,
and I got to tell you, I would have been a little fearful of the precedent that would have been set if the Supreme Court of the United States had given its blessing to extending an election in the midst of a pandemic, because there is another election coming up here in around November. Oh, yeah, that's right, for the president of the United States. And if the court had extended that election, yeah, all hell would have broken loose, or would break loose if the court would have done that. So I'm kind of glad the court set the precedent. We're not going to be extending elections. And I believe, I guess this was a primary, so they would not be talking about moving the general election. But I don't know. Well, that's a very fascinating case that came down. There was some other news this past week from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court announced that it will hear oral argument now. And so we've been in this pandemic. We've been in this lockdown, no public gatherings. And we've wondered, well, how can they then hold court when the public is not allowed to attend? Wouldn't that violate some kind of right to public hearings and public trials? Well, the Supreme Court said it's going to continue to hold hearings and oral argument, and these cases will be broadcast via live stream audio. Now, this is amazing. Mackenzie, what do you think about this?
I'm like so excited about this, and it's like,
really?
It's such a nerdy thing to be excited about, because the Supreme Court does release audio of all of its oral arguments, I think usually within like a week. So it's not
a week later.
Yeah. It's not that different than what, you know, is typically happens. But at the same time, you know, you don't have to, the only way you've been able to observe a live argument for the past 250 years has been to go to Washington, D.C., wait in a long line, sometimes sleep outside the court and hope to get in. So the fact that the general public will be able to listen contemporaneously is just like so exciting to me. And I feel like if I were a law professor teaching con law or whatever during this time, like, what a great opportunity to get online with your students, listen to the argument, and like live blog it or discuss it with each other. And it's just, I think it's great. And I'm going to listen to at least a couple. I think there are some pretty contentious or hot button cases that they're going to hear. So I'm pretty
all right. Let's do that. You make some great points there that, normally in the past, they will strip search you. I am telling you, they will not let you bring anything in that court. Nothing at all. And you're walking in there barely with your skivvies on, and that's it, to listen to oral argument. And now Yeah, in the comfort of your own home. Maybe also being your skivvies. But hey, at least that way it's less embarrassing. You can listen to the court course deliberations or their argument. Now, the first case that I was involved with that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, we actually had people stand in line. And this was a highly publicized case. The USA Today even wrote a front page article on this lawsuit. It was Galloway v. Greece. And we had people stand in line at 1:15 that morning. So in the middle of the night, they went and they stood in line just to hear argument. And guess what, Mackenzie? They did not get in. They did not get in. 1:15, they got in line and no go. They had to wait outside.
Wow. I mean, you definitely hear about that happening. And, you know, I'm not at a place in my career when I can say, like, the first time I had a case go to the Supreme Court. So no one's ever waited in line to see any of my arguments in court. I can say that with certainty. I mean, maybe my mom used to come to my criminal trials. It was really, she would come to every single one. And, like, it was pretty awesome. So, you know.
Also, moms are great for.
Yeah.
I know.
You cheer me on. It's great. I'm so excited about it.
I was almost embarrassed to have my parents come listen to some of my arguments. They'd be going, is this really how boring law actually is? Because it's nothing like what we see on TV. Yeah, that's right. It's nothing like what you see on TV. Which is a perfect segue now to let's talk about this movie, Philadelphia. Last week we covered My Cousin Vinny, and this week we're going to cover this movie, Philadelphia. Now, I forgot to mention last week, but last week My Cousin Vinny came out in 1992, so it was considered the 1993 Academy Awards. Marissa Tomei won Best Supporting Actress in 93 for her role there as Mona Lisa Vito. Did a great job. I loved Marissa Tomei's performance there. But nonetheless, Philadelphia came out a year later, so in 1993. Also coming out in 1993 was The Firm, another legal movie, which I'm sure we will be talking about here in a few some future podcasts. But Philadelphia came out in 1993. Tom Hanks was the lead actor. He won Best Actor here for his portrayal in this movie. Also, probably you might know that you're from Philadelphia. Are you a big fan of Bruce Springsteen?
I mean, Bruce is from New Jersey, so there is a little bit of a, you know, rivalry there. But yeah, no, the theme song from Philadelphia is awesome. And I think it won Best Song, right? Like, he totally deserved it.
Streets of Philadelphia by Bruce Springsteen. When you watch the movie, it's playing. It's as the opening credits are running, that is a song that is playing. It did win the Academy Award for Best Song, Best Original Song. And then I went and checked out the Grammys, and he pretty much cleaned up with that song as well. I'm a country music fan. I got to tell you, I had no idea what the song was about. I had to listen to it probably for the first time this past week, and it is a pretty catchy tune. And so the boss did win with that song. All right, well, let's start. And here's what I want to do, Mackenzie. I want to go through this movie, and let's just talk about the movie from a lawyer's perspective. Is this real stuff, or is this just Hollywood? And so at the end, we are going to be rating these movies with, we are going to have our own list of Hall of Fame lawyer movies, and we have to either stipulate that this movie belongs to it or make an objection, and the other one is allowed to overrule that objection. So, but let's go through this movie. What stood out to you with the opening scene?
So the opening scene is where, and I completely forgot about this scene from having watched it, you know, years and years ago, but the opening scene after the beautiful Bruce Springsteen montage at the beginning is Tom Hanks, who plays Andy Beckett, who's a senior associate at like this big white shoe Philadelphia law firm, which is also where I started my career. So I feel like I have some insight into the accuracy of this. He is arguing a preliminary injunction against Denzel Washington, who is supposed to be kind of like a Philly plaintiff's attorney. And in my job now, I litigate against a lot of Philly plaintiff's attorneys. So I feel insight there too. And there, for whatever, it's a construction case, I guess the injunction that Denzel Washington is asking for is to shut down construction on a skyscraper in Center City. And they're arguing it in chambers for like whatever reason. I don't know. You know, it makes no sense. It's like off the record. And
yeah, I didn't see a court reporter.
Yeah, there's no court reporter. And Tom Hanks kind of like goes on this like Hamlet-like soliloquy about justice and the Constitution. And like, you know, there's a lot of big words involved and stuff. And it's, I think it's a good setup for who the characters are movie-wise.
No, McKenzie, he said rapacious litigation. Have you ever heard that word, that phrase, ever in your practice? Rapacious litigation?
No, it reminds me of reading Shakespeare. Like, rapacious is a word. It exists. But I feel
like... Apparently. I'll take your word for it.
But, you know, especially, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm of the mind where there's a lot of hate directed against lawyers for using legalese and big words and trying to sound smarter than everybody else. And it you know, that's the kind of stuff that like gives us that reputation. And I'm like a big plain English advocate. So yeah, not a big fan of the rapacious litigation comment.
I attended this event, and Justice Clarence Thomas was speaking at this particular event, and he said that a lawyer's goal should be to not sound like a lawyer. So after you talk, if that other person then learns that you're a lawyer, you go, oh, wow, I had no idea. He sounded so, you know, like he made sense. I understood what he was saying. Yeah, that's kind of the point. You want to be able to be understood and communicate. That's what lawyers are supposed to do. You don't want to sound like a lawyer. And so just if you like to use that word rapacious, take it out of your lexicon.
And isn't it so funny that Denzel Washington's tagline in the movie is, explain it to me like I'm a 6-year-old, explain it to me like I'm a 4-year-old. And then at the end of the movie, the jury foreperson says that, explain it to me like I'm a 6-year-old, in the jury room. And that's kind of what wins.
That was a great scene.
Maybe it's an arc that, you know, the screenwriters were very intelligent about how they did this. I don't know.
That is a really good scene. Now, what I liked about that opening scene, too, then, is they go into the elevator. Do you remember that scene?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you have Denzel Washington and you have Tom Hanks, and there in the middle is a guy on crutches, which I believe is the second movie in a row we have seen where the lawyers encounter someone with crutches. So is this like a typical thing for lawyers to encounter? This must be a cliche.
I mean, it's definitely a cliche, but it's telling you the kind of attorney that Denzel Washington is, which is kind of like the same kind of attorney that Vinny is, right? Like, he's a slimy, stereotypical plaintiff's attorney. And like, if you've ever been, I will say, if you've ever been in the elevators in City Hall, Philadelphia, you know, it's not that far-fetched that there's just like a random person on crutches. There's all kinds of, like, those elevators, there's only one way to get to the courtrooms in City Hall, and you go through security, get your little badge, and then there's like two tiny, tiny ancient elevators, and you are crammed in there with whoever. So it's not totally far-fetched.
And so they're in the elevator, and they both take out their dictaphones. Now, that really took me back. I mean, I remember when I first went to a law firm to work in Kansas City, and they gave me a dictaphone. It intimidated me. It scared the bejeebies out of me. I had no idea. I never actually used that dictaphone, but apparently, again, that's a stereotypical lawyer thing to do. Did you ever use a dictaphone?
Oh, my gosh. No, I was in elementary school when this movie came out, so no. But I did, when I first...
You were in elementary school? Wow. Yeah. All right.
Maybe middle school. But when I first when I first started practicing like 10 years ago, and even more recently than that, I did work for partners who did dictate still, and I always thought it was like the weirdest thing, because I'm like, why would you not just type your own... I don't understand, just type the letter. But I guess there was like a generational, you know, some people never learned to type. Like before, if you grew up before there were computers, you never learned to type. And it's kind of a laborious thing to learn how to do later in life. So I get it. I mean, yeah, but I definitely never had one.
What I did at the very beginning was I actually typed out what I wanted the letter to say. And then I dictated that through my dictaphone and handed that to the secretary. I just didn't want to be embarrassed and say I didn't know how to use a dictaphone. But yeah, just type it out. Those things are so old school. Well, then the next scene of the movie, he's at his office and it is 6:30. And he is telling his secretary, go ahead and just go home. Now, he was just getting into the office. And then the next scene, it's 10:15. He is still working. Tell me, Mackenzie, please, that is not typical of the law firm life there in Philadelphia.
I think it's typical of law firm life in a lot of places.
Wow.
That is actually very accurate. I no longer work at a large law firm. I'm in the suburbs now and, you know, have much more flexible hours. But the only difference these days is now there's better takeout. But yeah, it's pretty dead on.
Wow. I just hope and pray I never have to get a real job. I love what I do. I teach lawyers. Much better gig. Now, I'm still speaking, and when I'm on the road, I'm going until 10:30 at night. But yeah, at a law firm, that would be pure hell for me. Did you notice those computers in these scenes?
Oh my gosh, it must have been so difficult to write things. Like it's like the blue font, like over a black screen.
Right, right.
I think it's just gonna like burn your corneas out after like a couple hours.
Oh, my God. I always find it so fascinating to see these old computers that are so long and heavy. And then you see them pop out their cell phones where it's like, you know, a ruler size cell phone. So huge. And yeah, just we've come a long ways here in these last 20 years. So what did you think about that whole scene next with he's having a meeting with the lawyers there? It's at 10:30 at night. Does that ring true to you in your experience with the Philadelphia legal scene?
I mean, it's not like totally out of the question. Obviously, the partners were at some dinner or event. They're all in tuxes and they were able to basically steal a huge client away from another firm. And they're excited about it. And they want to assign Tom Hanks to this case, which apparently the statute of limitations on filing a copyright infringement claim expires like literally the next day. So it seems like the worst assignment you could ever possibly, he's already at the office at 10:15 working on something else. And now he's being given this case. But yeah, I mean, I don't think like that is how business gets done, right? Like you're at a social event. I don't think that's really far out of the question. And they're having brandy and cigars and there's a lot of cliche about it. And, you know, the movie in general is pretty formulaic and a courtroom drama and does have a lot of tropes, but it's not totally off base. I mean, I don't find that the least believable part of the movie for sure.
Well, let's talk about that, the issue you just brought up, the statute of limitations. So they want him to draft this complaint. They want to put him on this huge client. Apparently, this firm just got a high-paying, high-priced client, going to make the firm tons of money. So they want Tom Hanks to be kind of the lead associate attached to that file. And that's very indicative of how law firms work. If you have a client, usually you'll have a couple handpicked lawyers who are most responsible for managing that client. And so apparently they want Tom Hanks to be one of those lawyers. And they give him a statute of limitations case, which I got to tell you, to me, that did not resemble real law because I believe he had dropped off. So he did all this work, drafting a complaint, highlighted it with instructions, left it on some lawyer's desk to review, and then took off. Now, apparently this is the day the statute of limitations runs. I just can't see myself ever doing that. I mean, I guess maybe I'm too paranoid about missing the statute that is a per se, ethical complaint and violation. Just go ahead and call your malpractice carrier and say, open up the bank. You can't miss statute of limitations. I would not drop that off on someone's desk with a sticky note thinking I have done my job. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've had my fair share of filing emergencies. Like, I'm not going to lie. It does happen. You know, I've had nights where I've been in a cab. I mean, the way things used to happen in federal court before everything went online is for a new case, like a complaint, you'd have to file it. I think most things you had to file in paper, but there was a drop box in the federal court where you could drop it in to get it stamped up until midnight. And I'm not going to lie. Like, I've been in a cab at like 11:45.
No.
Racing across town to run and put stuff in the Dropbox. So like that.
You have filed things before the midnight deadline at court.
Yeah, it has happened. And then, you know, I can't even remember what kind of cases. I want to say like, hopefully it was like injunctions or something that would have warranted that kind of emergency. But I feel like I've blocked it out. Like I have PTSD from all these things. And like, you know, in aviation law, what I do now is much more, genteel. Like we don't have, not that it never happens, but there are very much fewer, you know, dire fire drill emergencies. But I think, you know, you wouldn't be, well, who's this client that they're switching lawyers the day before the statute of limitations expires? Like, that's terrible. You wouldn't want to be filing a complaint on the statute of limitations deadline. And then you definitely wouldn't. I mean, if that's the case, you are personally walking that complaint into the clerk's office and you are not leaving until that stamp is on the complaint.
Right.
Like, you definitely, definitely wouldn't do that. Like, it just wouldn't happen.
Yeah, that is, I thought that was a little interesting, at least from my own personal standpoint. I would not feel that comfortable just dropping it off on someone's desk. And I think the next thing that he did was he called them. He called that partner much later in the day from the hospital. I think it was like 75 minutes left in the day. Yeah, that would not be real life stuff. I don't think. By the way, with your story, when you are racing to the federal court to file something to beat a deadline, did you like peer over into the gas tank indicator to see, make sure that your driver had enough gas to get you there?
I mean, yeah, like there are some memories that I have that are very like, this is why people find that kind of practice really stressful, because that's stress. And I don't want to, you know, we're living in a time where there are people dying and there's like real stress in the world. So I don't want to like hem and haw about how stressful big law firm, you're making a ton of money, you're compensated well, you got benefits. Like there's a lot of things that are going right in life if you're an associate at a big corporate law firm in Philadelphia, like for sure. However, I do have memories about, I mean, the level of stress that you're experiencing when you are about to like blow a deadline and you're in a cab in traffic or whatever other uncontrollable circumstance you're in. It's high. I mean, it's a high level of stress. It's not fun.
High stress.
Yeah,
it is. And I could not stand it. That's why I got out of it. I do remember one time being in the basement. And this does sound like a cliche, but it is absolutely the truth. I remember being in the basement of this big downtown building where I'm in the basement where all the archives and the banker's boxes of documents. Almost the entire floor was filled with banker boxes. And they told me, Joel, these are our clients' files. Go through them and find the smoking gun. I got to get a new life. This is not for me. I cannot do this. I don't even know what a smoking gun document looks like. And so that's when I realized I had to get out. All right. Well, then enters Denzel Washington, the whole, the movie shifts forward where Tom Hanks' character goes to Denzel Washington and says, hey, will you take my case? I've been fired unjustly, wrongful discrimination. And now you had an interesting take on this claim. What's your take?
So what I found interesting, I'm not an employment lawyer and I don't know that much about, you know, it's a very specialized area of the law, but I did notice like all the courtroom scenes where the trial of this case that Tom Hanks brings against the law firm for firing him is in City Hall, which is Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas. It's the trial level court for Pennsylvania. So it's not a federal claim. And it's like a common law wrongful termination claim under Pennsylvania state law, which I thought was interesting. So I started looking into it.
And why is that?
Just because I know that most employment you know, wrongful termination cases are brought in federal court under the Civil Rights Act, right? So
there's a federal law, ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. This seemed to be directly covered by that, and you would file those in federal court. And you picked up that this was filed in state court. So what did your research tell you?
So, yeah, that and then the library scene where they're talking about the precedent, and it's a United States Supreme Court case, and it wasn't talking about any law I had ever heard of. And I thought to myself, why isn't this talking about the ADA? And I looked it up, and it turns out that the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, was not enacted until 1990, which is probably right around the time that they were actually filming this movie. And, you know, the screenplay may have been written well before that. So that just really shocked me. I mean, it seems so late to me that you know, those protections didn't exist before 1990 under federal law. I mean, it was a little shocking to me. And it does go to show you how far we've come in 20 years, and it makes me think, like, where will we be 20 years from now? The fact that that's shocking to me is kind of a good thing. Like, we take things for granted, and they definitely, you know, in our lifetime, they didn't exist, that's for sure.
Well, it's interesting to me that while this movie is being written and produced, the law is actually being changed that would affect the subject matter of this lawsuit, which is also somewhat interesting because, as we're going to talk a little bit later, this film was actually based loosely on an actual real case. And so you have that connection. Well, also during this part of the movie, you had one of my favorite scenes where Denzel Washington goes into some suite at a Sixers basketball game where Dr. J is in that suite, and he personally serves the opposing side with a summons, which I assume would be the filing of that lawsuit. Have you ever had that moment where you actually served the opposing side with papers?
Yeah, no, you don't want to do that, first of all. And I don't know what the rules of procedure said back then. But first of all,
let me tell you, in Kansas, you can't do it. If you're the lawyer, you cannot do that.
Yeah, I don't think the lawyer can do that. But in Philadelphia County, unlike the rest of the counties in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia County, you actually have to serve original process by the sheriff. So you can't even serve it by hand, like as a civilian anyway. So that would never happen. But yeah, like as the lawyer, not only can you not, but like, why would you want to do that? I don't know why you would want to do that.
No, I mean, yeah, I'd want to meet Dr. J, but assuming that was just a fluke thing, that was definitely made for Hollywood. In real life, here's how that happens. You use the sheriff, or in other jurisdictions or in the federal court, you can use a special process server. It has to be someone who's independent that serves it, not on the lawyer, but on the actual defendant. If it's a corporation, they would have someone who is deemed to accept the service of process on behalf of the corporation. I guess they were serving the law firm, so they would be the defendant in this case. So I guess they were serving the defendant. But nonetheless, he then asked Dr. J for work, which also is a violation of our ethical rules. I believe that would be a solicitation of clientele, a violation of, I think it's Rule 7.3. Now, what did you think of the partner's response to this lawsuit? You mentioned earlier that their strategy probably doesn't square with what the actual strategy would be in these type of cases.
Meaning, like, you know, the fact that they allow the case to go to a jury trial. That's
right. You would never let this go see a jury, would you?
No. I mean, no law firm I'm aware of would ever let it get to that point. Apparently it happened in only 7 months' time. They were like in front of a jury in City Hall, but like, I don't think corporations don't like when their executives get on the stand. A law firm is going to have their senior partners get on a witness stand,
right,
and be cross-examined in public and on the record. And I just don't, that's not believable to me at all.
And perjure themselves. I mean, this senior partner knew what the actual facts were. Like right now, you know, Trump is never going to be deposed. They were never going to actually put him under subpoena. You're not going to subject yourself to perjury. No one would do that. It's a last recourse. These lawyers, they would not have followed that strategy. I'm thinking they would have allowed this to go away quietly, would have paid them some money. Number one, one of those lawyers would have realized what they did was wrong, but even if they didn't think what they did was wrong, surely they didn't want this to go away quickly and quietly and not actually have it reach a jury trial.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know what the requirements would be for private sealed mediation, but I have to feel like that's the direction these types of things would go in and not, you know, not a jury trial. But hey, it makes for great, you know, cinema, so I'm all for it.
Exactly. All right. Another thing that makes for good cinema, it was the opening scene in court. I don't know if you remember the scene, but there on the left was Denzel Washington with Tom Hanks. And on the other side, they had to bring in probably 15 other chairs. They had like a table. I don't know, 12, I think I counted them, lawyers sitting at that table. No lawyer would let that happen, right? That's just not a good look for the jury.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you do see like a lot more attorneys on, you know, the corporate slash defense side of things often. But I completely agree, especially in state court. I mean, Philadelphia is a very unique jurisdiction. We have very unique jurors. You don't want to come off as, you know, the pompous, overpacked counsel table. Like, it's just not a good look for the jury. And yeah, big strategic error on their part.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, here's Captain Obvious talking now. Everyone loves the David and Goliath story. They like to root for the underdog. And here, when this is about the underdog being discriminated against, don't make it blatant. Don't broadcast your strength, your mightiness into numbers. That's just going to cut against you when the jury goes back to deliberate. So that was definitely not a good look. What about this scene here? I'll take you to a later on. I don't know if you remember. They had this former, or maybe she was a current employer with the firm who had AIDS. And this the lawyers knew that this lady had AIDS because she had lesions on her skin. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
And they had her on the stand. And so they made it a point to bring out in front of the jury that she was not terminated because she got AIDS by a blood transfusion. It was not because of her being a lesbian. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
Now, did that confuse you?
Well, I mean, I guess. So if you're bringing a common law wrongful discharge claim in Pennsylvania, you have to show that the termination was motivated by some kind of, I don't want to say malice, but it has to be like against public policy. So I think they were trying to show the difference between, you know, the animus that the partners had for Tom Hanks because he was gay versus, you know, they had sympathy or, you know, just felt neutral towards someone who had the same affliction but was not gay. So I think it was like necessary for the plot. But yeah, it's also an educational tool. I think there's a lot about the movie that was very timely. Right. And I think the screenwriters were probably trying to, you know, educate the audience as well. But as far as Denzel Washington is concerned, I think he's trying to meet his burden of proof with respect to the, I'll call it the animus element. And, you know, I don't know exactly what the element is.
Right, But in that scene, it was the lawyer for the law firm who pointed out that, look, you did not acquire HIV based upon your lifestyle choices. And I'm thinking that cuts against your main theory of the case. In fact, I would have expected Denzel Washington to bring that up. That's why they did not fire you, because they did not object to your lifestyle, whereas my client, they did not like it. They did not approve of his lifestyle, and so they terminated him. I would have thought that would have been something Denzel Washington would have drawn out, but it was the other side's lawyers who drew that out. And I'm saying, if that were actually a real court case, that would have been a fact that went against the law firm, not for the law firm. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah. Like, I don't know why that would come from. I can't think of a good reason to ask that question, actually.
Yeah. Denzel would have brought that up. Now, I guess you could have brought it up to preempt the other side, but it's definitely not one in your favor. And the way the movie played it out, they were like glad that she was saying, I was not a lesbian, so I did not acquire the HIV from my lifestyle choice.
Assuming that the jurors would be so prejudicial against a gay person, I don't know. Yeah, there's no good reason for that.
Yeah. Well, how about this next scene where Tom Hanks falls in front of the jury, collapses in front of the jury? Do you remember that scene?
Yes.
Well, what is your take on that? Would that not result in a mistrial?
I mean, yeah, it's Philadelphia.
Right.
I've seen some things. It definitely should have resulted in a motion for a mistrial. That's for sure. It's something that shouldn't, it's going to skew the jurors' perceptions one way or another. And I think, maybe in 1993, it's not clear which way, but yeah, definitely not something that should be part of what the jury sees, for sure. And it should have been, mistrial motion at the very least.
And then, of course, one of the high points as far as the tension of the litigation, the movie, was when they had Tom Hanks take his shirt off to display the lesions that would have been visible.
Oh, absolutely. It was totally the Johnny Cochran, if the glove don't fit, moment. And it's really powerful. And, my experience with juries as well is like the power of demonstrative evidence cannot be overstated. Like sitting in a jury box for 8 hours a day for who knows how many days or weeks is really boring if you're just listening to people talk all day, every day. The minute that a witness gets down from the stand to conduct an experiment or, shows a physical object, like you see those jurors' faces light up. Like this is the most exciting thing to happen all day. So it's very powerful. It's something that sticks in jurors' minds. They're not going to forget that. It evokes an emotional reaction. Like it's an extremely effective litigation tool for sure.
A lot of lawyers and also non-lawyers who watch legal movies and follow legal proceedings, we often mistakenly view juries as computer systems. We're just running this through the computer system. It's going to be an app that's going to churn out the right verdict because we inputted all this information. That's not reality. Jurors are humans. They lose attention. Some things mean more to them than others. So, if you can have a demonstration that really can reach the jury at a different level, that obviously is going to score some major points for your side. All right, any other takeaways from the movie that caught your attention that you want to address?
I think it was great how the movie actually showed the jury deliberations. I thought that was really cool.
It's
like we always want to get into the jury room and, see what goes on in there. And sometimes you get these verdicts where you're like, what were they thinking? This case, it was kind of clear cut. You don't have the 17-page verdict form with a questionnaire, detailed questionnaire to kind of but it was great to see the deliberations occurring. And then I also thought like the damages that were awarded, there's this focus on the $4 million of punitive damages, which are recoverable, but people might have missed the fact that the jury awarded $100,000 in damages for mental anguish, pain and suffering, which like has no part in a wrongful discharge case. Like mental anguish is like, if you're physically maimed or something, or you have some kind of like physical injury, and then you also have pain and suffering, but you don't get pain and suffering for, the only analogy I can think of is like a defamation case, but this wasn't that. So he wouldn't have been able to recover that, but I guess it's, small beans compared to the $4 million in punitive that he's getting. This law firm. And that is why a law firm would never take this case to trial.
Yes.
Because they're not going to get a lot of business after this.
Yeah, what would you really want that kind of attention? Look, we love to discriminate. And so then you also lose this lawsuit. So now you question their legal acumen. There's a lot of different reasons why this would never happen. I say that, but that is a perfect segue to my next thought, which is This actually was loosely based on a real life lawsuit, which has, it's an interesting story in and of itself. Apparently, Jeffrey Bowers and Clarence Kane, two separate cases. Bowers sued his law firm, Baker McKenzie, for a wrongful dismissal in 1987. This was one of the first AIDS discrimination cases. And then also, Kane, was an attorney for Hyatt Legal Services, was fired after his employer found out that he had AIDS, and he sued Hyatt, and then he won his case right before he died. Now, the Bowers situation, his family then met with the writers and producers for this movie. And so they talked about this movie. They met with a producer whose name was Scott Rudin, but apparently Scott Rudin then left this project and did not share his notes. Nonetheless, the Bowers family sued the writers and producers of Philadelphia, saying, "You owe us money because you based this movie off of our situation and our interview and our stories," and that case was settled. So any parting thoughts on the movie Philadelphia?
I mean, I think it's a wonderful movie. It's like, I adore Tom Hanks. He's like a national treasure. So even, and Denzel too, actually. And there's like, we didn't even talk about that. Antonio Banderas is in this movie. I mean, there's some real star power that should make you want to watch it anyway. It also is such a zeitgeist. Like, it's a cultural moment that I think is so, you know, important in our country. It is a formulaic courtroom drama, like, for sure. But I think in this situation, the formula really does serve a purpose, and it pushes the plot, you know, in the right direction, and it's necessary to the movie. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a great movie. It's definitely worth a watch or a rewatch.
You mentioned Antonio Banderas. I forgot to mention that was another one of my favorite parts of the movie when they went to this costume party. I don't know if it was Halloween or if it was just a costume party, but you had Denzel Washington show up as a law suit. Apparently he had a bunch of laws all over his suit, and that was his costume as being a law suit. I got to try that some Halloween. That might be a creative thing to wear. I don't know what your spouse would wear, but I guess you could be the lawsuit and they could be the summons. I am not sure. Well, let me go ahead. We want to have some way to evaluate these movies. And so we talked about, let's have our list of movies of our legal Hall of Fame. And I am going to, now we can stipulate that this movie belongs in the Hall of Fame, or we can object to it. I am going to object to this being in our Hall of Fame because they focused way too much on opera. In fact, there was one scene there where the opera was singing, and I just could barely stomach it. I was like, come on, where's my country music? That was a hard scene for me to watch. I'm going to throw you out an objection. Are you going to sustain my objection, or are you going to overrule it?
No, I vigorously overrule. I think that's Puccini, first of all. So, like, don't hate on opera. It's so powerful. And I, you know, I'm going to say this so wrong, and it's going to come back and haunt me. I'm not like an opera, you know, aficionado or anything. I enjoyed that scene in the movie, but I think that's the scene in the movie where Denzel Washington kind of has his spiritual awakening, and he realized that
right.
He's prejudiced. And I think in that opera by Puccini, which I don't even remember what opera it is, so it just shows you how ignorant I am. I think like the character is having a similar spiritual awakening. So it's,
yes.
You know, I mean, I'm down for it. And I think it's a great movie. It definitely belongs in the Hall of Fame, but I'm also, you know, I don't know if I have to recuse myself here because I'm from Philadelphia. So maybe, you know, it should be decided by
brilliant.
A jurist. I don't know.
Brilliant. Yes, we should recuse you for bias here, but nonetheless, all right. We'll admit it. It's a great movie. It does in its favor. It won some awards, so you know it was a quality done movie. It does represent the legal profession somewhat accurately, though there are some shortcomings and there are strategies that probably would not play out in real life. It's still, it's courtroom drama. It has that courtroom moment, right, where, hey, take your shirt off and show the The jurors, the lesions, that was probably not up there in the, you know, Colonel Jessel, Lieutenant Caffrey moment of you can't handle the truth, son. But still, it was a good moment there in court. So, yeah, I think you are right there. We'll go ahead and put it in our list of top lawyer movies. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. Look us up on Facebook, on Instagram. We want to hear from you. We'd love to hear your ideas. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom, well, this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Our marketing team of Redbird Solutions and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. For Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.